So now we've finished talking about quantum algorithms. Of course, there are many other interesting things we could talk about related to quantum algorithms, but alas, we have to move on and talk about a few other topics before time runs out. So today what I want to do is a little bit of introduction to open quantum systems, where we have systems that are not necessarily described by pure quantum states and unitary dynamics, right? So this was sufficient for our discussion of quantum computation, because we really wanted the state to stay pure, and we wanted to kind of make use of interference and maximally quantum behavior in order to get computational speed up. And we'll see later on when we talk about fault tolerance and the threshold theorem that provided you can build a good enough quantum computer, you can make this idealization that you really have pure it's reasonable to make this idealization that you really have pure quantum states and unitary dynamics. But of course, in the real world, we have noisy systems, and so we have to deal with the fact that our systems will not necessarily always be pure. And so we need to kind of understand the formalism of what happens when we have quantum systems that are not described by pure states, and what kinds of evolutions they can undergo. And also, we can think about a more generalized notion of measurement, which goes hand in hand with these other notions, that is useful for thinking about the best possible way to distinguish quantum states. So these will be useful notions to have if we want to think about if we want to think about encoding information in quantum states more generally, and if we want to think about how to handle noisy quantum systems. So some of these concepts I imagine are familiar to you. Surely you know what a density matrix is, and I'll just kind of briefly remind you about this. Probably you've seen quantum operations before, but maybe I'll mention some details about representations of quantum operations that perhaps some of you haven't seen. And my understanding is that some of you have seen the notion of POVMs in the Quantum Foundations class, but not everyone took that. So this will be maybe a review for some of you and new for some others of you. But if at any time you want me to just kind of speed up or you want me to slow down, let me know. I appreciate the feedback. Okay, good. So, and there'll be a theme kind of running through this, which has to do with why we call these systems open quantum systems. So, a way that you can get evolution, which will take a pure state into a mixed state, is to think about coupling a quantum system to some other quantum system, but then forgetting about the system that you couple to. So you might explicitly choose to discard it, or you might effectively have to discard it because it might be some system you don't have any control over. Like, it might be the environment of your quantum computer. And so if you have evolution between a system which is, you would like to think that it's in a pure state, and maybe the global system really is in a pure state, but the system involves some piece that you don't have access to, then you get evolution, which will produce mixed quantum states. And so if we think about systems which are open, systems which can evolve, into states that involve some coupling with the environment, then, that's a way that these kinds of systems can arise. Okay, so we'll see throughout that actually, all of these notions, they'll give us some more general notion of what we mean by states and operations and measurements, but we'll always be able to interpret them in terms of something which involves pure states and which involves unitary evolutions. And so this kind of notion of purification is a powerful way sometimes to think about what's happening with these more general operations. And there's this phrase which is sometimes used to describe this point of view, that you can always make things pure, and you can always think about the dynamics as being unitary, which is called the church of the larger Hilbert space. So we can always just think, if we're willing to think about a bigger Hilbert space, which includes the environment and anything that the system might have interacted with, we can always think of things as effectively pure. Okay, good. So let's start off with density matrices. So far, we've talked exclusively about pure quantum states, but we could think about states which are described by statistical mixtures of quantum states. So if we're given a pure quantum state psi, then we can think about this as corresponding to a density matrix, which still describes the same pure quantum state. And the symbol we usually use for a density matrix is rho. And the density matrix corresponding to the pure state psi is just the projector onto psi. So you see that actually some information is thrown out when we go from psi to the projector onto psi. Namely, if we multiply psi by any phase, if we have e to the I theta psi, then that just corresponds to, rho being e to the I theta psi psi, you know, the adjoint of psi e to the minus I theta. So in other words, exactly the same density matrix. Okay, so the information about the global phase goes away when we think about the density matrix. And maybe that's actually a good thing, because the global phase is not information that we can get access to. It's not physically relevant information. And that's sort of the only information which is thrown away when we go from psi to rho, because, you know, we can always recover what the state psi is up to a global phase by just figuring out, you know, what is the state that it's a projector onto, right? So this is a rank one projector, and if we figure out what's the state that it projects onto, that tells us what the pure state is. Okay, so more generally, we could have a statistical mixture of pure states. So if we have an ensemble of pure states, which is prepared in the following way, so we're given the state psi I with probability pi. Okay, so this describes a procedure for preparing a system in some state. You flip a coin that, you know, is going to have outcome I. Maybe it's not a two-sided coin, but it's an n-sided coin. And it's going to give you outcome I with probability p sub I. And then when you get outcome I, you prepare the state psi I, and then you forget about what the outcome was that you got. So you don't have access to this information about which outcome you got. Well, then this is going to be described by a density matrix. And the density matrix is simply the appropriate convex combination of the density matrices for the pure states. So rho in this case is just the sum over I, pi, times the projector onto psi I. So this just corresponds to convex combination, and so we can think about this density matrix as describing the state. And now all of the information that we could, in principle, get out of measurements applied to this ensemble of states, so the system that was prepared using this ensemble description, all of that information actually is available in the density matrix row. Yes. That's right. So this is a probability distribution. So of course the PIs are greater than or equal to 0, and the sum of the PIs are equal to 1. And so if you combine some things according to some probability distribution, that's a convex combination. So those are the only constraints that we have.
Well, is that all a convex combination is?
Yes.
An nonlinear combination in which the coefficients sum to 1.
And are positive.
And are positive.
Yes, exactly. That's what we mean by a convex combination. Okay, good. So this is the notion of a density matrix corresponding to what's called a mixed state. So if we have a state which is not pure, we say that it's mixed. So this is in general a mixed state. If what we get is not just a rank one projector. Okay, so maybe it's helpful to think about a picture of these states in the case where we just have a qubit. So we can go back to the Bloch sphere. So remember, the Bloch sphere, was a real sphere of radius 1 in three dimensions. So here we have our x-axis, our y-axis, and our z-axis. And we had, the pure quantum states being exactly, they corresponded exactly to points on the surface of this Bloch sphere, where we throw away this global phase information, which is great because we're throwing that information away anyway if we talk about the density matrix. So this is the state 0, this is the state 1, this is the state plus, this is the state minus, etc. And so now when we talk about taking a convex combination of pure states in order to get a mixed state, if we think about that in this geometric picture, it really corresponds exactly to taking convex combination in the usual geometric sense, right? So for example, if we were to prepare some mixture of the state 0 and the state 1, then we could think about that as corresponding to a point in the Bloch sphere, now really inside the Bloch sphere, which lies somewhere on the z-axis, right? Because all the points that we get by taking convex combinations of this state and this state just lie along the z-axis somewhere. And where they lie on the z-axis depends on what's the probability that we have. So for example, if we were to prepare, the state 0 with probability a half and the state 1 with probability a half, then we would get the following density matrix. So if we do, probability 1 half, we do 0, and 1 half, we do 1. This is going to give us 1 half 0, 0 plus 1, 1. Okay, which is just the 2x2 identity matrix, well, divided by 2. So something that you can see is certainly that for something to be a density matrix, actually it's going to have to be the case that its trace is equal to 1. So that follows from the fact that, you know, for a pure state, the trace of the projector onto psi is 1. And then if we just take a convex combination of such things, we always get something that has trace 1. And another property that we see, well, in this example and also in general, is that rho has to be a positive semi-definite matrix, meaning that all of its eigenvalues have to be non-negative. So, and this is also clear because if we take a convex combination of positive semi-definite matrices, we always get positive semi-definite. We always get a positive semi-definite matrix, and you know, a rank 1 projector is positive semi-definite. Okay, and we see that in this example as well. In fact, in this case, the thing actually has full rank. It's just the identity divided by 2. And this state has a special name. This is called the maximally mixed state. So this is as mixed as we could get. So that corresponds to this point here. So this is the density matrix I over 2. Okay, then just one other small point that I wanted to make about density matrices is that the representation of the density matrix is does not uniquely determine the ensemble, right? So if I know what the matrix is, I know what this density matrix here is, it doesn't necessarily tell me how the state was prepared as a convex combination of pure states. So for example, you know, suppose I were to prepare the state plus with probability a half and the state minus with probability a half. Well, if you look at things geometrically, clearly that's going to give you the same thing, right? Because the center of the Bloch sphere is equally, you know, is halfway between plus and minus, just as it's halfway between 0 and 1. Right? So you know, you could do that calculation explicitly if you wanted, but I guess it should be clear that if you prepare the plus state with probability a half and the minus state with probability a half, you also get rho as the identity divided by 2. So the density matrix does not uniquely determine the ensemble. You could have many ensembles realizing the same density matrix. And so I said before that, you know, the density matrix really has all the information in it that you need in order to predict the outcomes of measurements. So that must mean that, you know, there's some additional information in the ensemble that's somehow not physically relevant, right? If all you have is a state which was prepared either according to this ensemble or according to this ensemble, those states are just indistinguishable. There's just no experiment you can do to ever tell whether the state was prepared this way or this way. Okay, so the ensemble is not unique. Probably you've seen this before, but maybe it bears repeating. Okay, so that's just a very quick reminder of some things about density matrices. But now I just also want to mention this thing about purification, right? So I said, you know, we could think about this picture where whenever we have a mixed state, we can always imagine that it's realized by having a pure quantum state of some larger system. So this is another kind of basic fact to keep in mind. So any quantum, mixed quantum state can be purified. And what do I mean by that? Well, it means whenever you have a density matrix, let's say for all density matrices rho A, so I write subscript A to mean this is a state of system A, then there actually exists some pure quantum state of a larger system of, let's say, of a system AB, where you should think of this, you know, B part as some reference system. And what you can do is you can trace out the reference system from the pure state psi in order to get the density matrix rho. So such that if I take the partial trace over B of this state, and this state, if I think of it as a density matrix, is, you know, it's the projector onto psi AB, this gives me exactly rho. Have you seen this before? Everybody's seen this before. So do you remember how to purify the state? So suppose suppose I have some density matrix rho. How do I actually construct a purification? Remember? So let me, actually, one thing I could do is I could try to write rho in its eigenbasis, right? So I could always diagonalize rho, and I could write rho is the sum over I of some states phi I, pi, right? So that would be one way of realizing rho as a mixture of pure states, would be to, take each of the eigenstates of rho and prepare it with probability equal to its eigenvalue. So that would be one way of realizing the state. So then how can I construct the purifying state? I have to somehow introduce a reference system, and somehow I have to use these states phi I. Yes?
State will be sum over I of
phi
I and then
separate
the new basis state.
Right.
And different
from
each phi I.
Right, exactly. Okay. So okay, exactly, right. So we take psi to be the sum over I, the square root of pi phi I tensor I. Then this is exactly a purification of the state. So this is just what you said. You can easily check that if you take the density matrix of this state and then you take the partial trace over this register, then you'll get back exactly this state. Okay, so this is a purification, but notice that the purification is not unique. So, there are many other things you could have told me. I guess maybe you did in some sense tell me all the purifications because you didn't tell me in what basis you should specify this reference system. And indeed, any basis is fine. So you could take these I's to be any basis for the reference system, and that would be fine. So in other words, there's some unitary freedom. If you're going to trace out the reference system, you could change the basis in any way before you trace it out, and it's not going to make a difference. So the purification certainly is not unique, but this is one way of writing the purification. And another thing you see from this is that you don't need too large a reference system. So, this is supposed to be some basis for the reference system, but you only need a number of basis states which is equal to, the rank of the density matrix rho, so the number of phi i's that actually appear. Okay. So this is all I'm going to say about density matrices. So any questions? Okay, good. So the next thing is about quantum operations. So, when we talked about the evolution of pure quantum states, we wanted maps that would send, unit vectors to unit vectors in some complex vector space. So that was exactly the unitary transformations. But now if we think about density matrices and the evolution of density matrices, then we should think about maps that send density matrices to density matrices. So, so quantum operations are maps that always send density matrices to density matrices. So they should satisfy some properties. I mean, there are some things that definitely have to be satisfied in order for a map to be a quantum operation. So first of all, it should be, certainly such a map should be linear. Because in particular, if we want to think about, preparing some ensemble of pure states and using that to realize a density matrix, well, the action of the quantum operation on the density matrix should be the same thing as acting with the quantum operation individually on the elements of the ensemble and then mixing afterwards. Okay, so we want to have some operation which is linear. So I'll write these quantum operations in general with script capital letters. So let me write E. So E of, if I take, for example, P times rho plus 1 minus P sigma, this should give me P times E of rho plus 1 minus P times E of sigma. Okay, so that's the basic property, is that we should have a linear map. The next property is that they should be trace preserving, because remember the density matrix, a density matrix that describes a valid quantum system should always have trace one, and that property should be preserved when we apply the map. So it should be trace preserving. So the trace of E of rho should be the same thing as the trace of rho, which of course will be one if rho is actually a density matrix. Okay, so another property that they should have is that they should be positivity preserving. Because remember, a density matrix corresponds to a positive semi-definite matrix. So what I mean by this is that if rho is positive semi-definite, as it must be if it's a density matrix, then E of rho should also be positive semi-definite. But actually, it turns out that this is not enough. So there's another condition that you need in order to sort of ensure that something like this holds, regardless of the input that you might make to the channel, to the quantum operation, which is that, you know, in principle, you could think about acting with a quantum operation on a piece of a larger system. We always have to think about the possibility that we have some larger system around. And so what we actually need is something which is really strictly stronger than 3, which is that our map should be completely positive. So I'll write this as follows. So if I take the tensor product of E and the identity quantum operation, so this is just the thing that sends rho to rho, and if I, you know, so the tensor product is defined in just sort of just the way you would expect. So if you act with it on some tensor product state, then it just acts, you know, the quantum operations just act individually, and then it acts in general by linearity. So this thing acting on any state rho, so now rho is a state of a larger system, this should be positive semi-definite if rho is positive semi-definite. And so this is actually a, you know, strictly stronger condition. So by that I mean there are maps that are positive, but not completely positive. So I don't know, have you seen this before? Do you know an example of a map that's positive but not completely positive? Yes. So you know, okay, so you've seen this before. So, right, so the transpose is positive but not completely positive. And this relates to the detection of entanglement. So of course, if you have some unentangled state rho that you put in here, then this sort of issue won't come up because the thing is just acting individually. But if you put in some entangled state, then more interesting things can happen. And so you can think about using this notion of the partial transpose actually as a way of detecting entanglement. Okay, great. So I guess the last thing that I wanted to do, having to do with quantum operations, was just to give you some simple examples of quantum operations on single qubits. So the three that I was going to mention, but maybe you can just tell me if you've all seen these before, I won't do it. So there's something called the depolarizing channel, something called phase damping, and something else called amplitude damping. And maybe it's helpful to see what these are in order to have a kind of a picture of what quantum operations can do geometrically, at least to a qubit, in a way that goes beyond you know, what unitary operations do. So have you all seen these before? Do you know what these operations are? I'm seeing some heads being shaken. Who has seen these things before? Who knows what these are?
The last two in quantum theory, but it was a while ago.
Okay, so maybe I'll just very quickly say what these things are. So the depolarizing channel is the following map. So this is the map that sends some input density matrix rho to an output density matrix that, well, with probability 1 minus p is just the same as the input density matrix. And with probability p over 3, is, so the remaining probability is p, and then there are, you know, three things that we're going to do, each with a third of the remaining probability. We'll do x rho x. So this is the unitary operation that corresponds to doing a poly x operation on rho, because, of course, you know, if we want to apply a unitary operation on a density matrix, that corresponds to conjugation by the unitary. So plus y rho y plus z rho z. And so something that you can show is that this is the same thing as, I think it's 1 minus 4p over 3 rho plus 4p over 3, the identity. So in other words, you can think about this as mixing the current density matrix that you have with the identity. So it's useful maybe to think about what these operations do to the block sphere. So of course, unitary matrices, unitary transformations just rotate the block sphere. They keep the surface of the block sphere where it is, and they just, you know, swivel it around in some way. So more generally, when you have quantum operations that are not unitary, they'll correspond to some way of shrinking the block sphere. And the depolarizing channel is really kind of uniformly shrinking the block sphere so that even if you have an arbitrary pure quantum state as input, you'll always have a mixed quantum state as output. So the, you know, the block sphere, which is initially some sphere of radius 1, will shrink down to something smaller. And the shrinking is really uniform in all directions. So this is, you have to imagine that what I drew is actually a sphere. But use your imagination. Okay. So this is a map that we can think of as randomly applying some unitary operation. And the effect that it geometrically is this, that it sort of makes the state more and more mixed. It takes things uniformly towards the maximally mixed state. OK, so another possibility, something which is a little bit simpler even to write down, is what's called phase damping. And this is where we take the state rho and we replace it with some other rho, which is just 1 minus p times rho plus p times 0 z. So in other words, we've made some choice of basis here, but we only randomly apply either the identity map or we conjugate by z. Yes?
When you're talking about the depolarizing channel right at the end, you said randomly applies the unitary?
Yes. That's kind of the interpretation of what this is. So with probability 1 minus p, we do the identity. With probability p over 3, we do x. Probability p over 3, we do y. And with probability p over 3, we do z. Right, so here, what we're doing is just with probability 1 minus p, we're doing the identity. And with probability p, we're doing a z operation. So this is a sense in which some noise has been applied to the qubit. And so what does this look like geometrically? Well, now you can see that there are some pure states that stay fixed. Right? Because if our pure state is an eigenstate of z, if it's a computational basis state, then nothing's going to happen. So the state is actually going to stay the same. But on the other hand, if the state is in the equator of the block sphere, it's going to be maximally affected. And if you work out what happens geometrically, we have the following kind of picture. So initially, we have the pure quantum states. The state 0 and the state 1 are going to be unaffected, but everything will be shrunk down in the other directions. So the manifold of pure states will shrink down to something that looks like this. And the shrinking is symmetric about the x and the y axes. So it shrinks down to this kind of cigar-shaped object. Incidentally, you could wonder whether it might be possible to, say, have something that keeps the 0 and the 1 states the same, but shrinks you down by different amounts in the x and the y directions. Right? So maybe it flattens the thing down into a pancake, so it keeps the 0 and the plus and the 1 and the minus state actually all the same, but it shrinks things down in the y direction. And that's actually not possible. It's just not consistent with the axioms for quantum operations. I mean, a quantum operation is just something that satisfies all of these conditions, and there just isn't something that satisfies all of these conditions that has that kind of behavior. So that's something you could think about, how you would actually show that. Actually, I'm going to give another characterization of quantum operations, I guess, in just a second, from which it might be easier to see that that's the case. Okay, so the final thing is something called amplitude damping. Is a quick example of a quantum operation. Yes?
Before we leave phase damping, would you mind explaining explicitly why we call it phase damping?
Oh, yeah, okay, good. So, if you think about what this does to the density matrix, So, you know, a density matrix has some matrix elements. So, you know, A, B, A, B, C, D, like this. And, you know, you can think about, so, you know, these diagonal elements of the density matrix correspond to the probabilities of the 0 and the 1 state. And the, you know, the B and the C elements correspond to some coherences between those state, those states 0 and 1, which have to do with, you know, information about the relative phase between 0 and 1. And, you know, another way of thinking about what happens if you apply this map is that it keeps these entries the same, but it shrinks these entries. So it's shrinking the phase coherence. It's making the state have less phase coherence. So A and D stay the same, B and C shrink.
And just the square modulus
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, I guess its phase will actually stay the same. I mean, if you were to change the phase of B and C, that would correspond to some rotation about the z-axis. So here I'm imagining that we're sort of modding out by anything unitary, and we're just thinking about how the thing shrinks. Of course, you could think about, you know, composing phase damping with some rotation, and then the picture would be the same because it would just shrink down and the thing would rotate.
So when you say B and C shrink, then it's the
Right. Okay, good. Other questions? Okay, so amplitude damping is another example, but now this is actually an example that we cannot write in the way that I've already written these operations. So you know, here what I did was I had some interpretation that I was randomly picking some unitary operation to do, right? So you know, I did either the identity or I did the z operation with some different probabilities that would give me some operation applied to the state. That would certainly be not unitary, and it would be a more general quantum operation. But there are quantum operations that simply are not convex combinations of unitary operations. They just involve doing more general things. And so a way of writing amplitude damping is the following. So rho gets sent to a0 rho a0 dagger plus a1 rho a1 dagger, where A0 and A1 are the following matrices, which are certainly not unitary. Actually, maybe I'd better look this up so I don't make a mistake. Right. So A0 is 1, 0, 0, square root of 1 minus gamma. And A1 is 0, square root of gamma, 0, 0. OK, so clearly these are not unitary matrices. I mean, this one's, you know, I guess not even a normal matrix. I mean, it's, you know, these are not the kinds of matrices you're used to writing down when you think about operations, at least, you know, unitary operations acting on quantum states. But you can show that actually, if you consider some operation of this form, it actually has all of the properties up here. So it's manifestly linear, and it's pretty easy to see that it's trace preserving. And actually, I mean, maybe it's a little bit harder to see that it's completely positive, but it is. Okay, so so sometimes these things are called completely positive trace preserving maps. So this is a CPTP map or a quantum operation. And what does this do to the pure states on the Bloch sphere? Well, now, this is an operation which, well, the reason that you can't write it as a convex combination of unitaries, well, one reason that you can't do that is that it's not even what's called unital. So it's not a map that preserves the maximally mixed state. So actually, the maximally mixed state gets sent to something else. And more or less what this thing looks like is, so it will preserve the zero state, and it will send the manifold of all the pure states to something that looks kind of like this. Okay, so things shrink away from the one state. Actually, the one state is, I guess, the state which is affected the most by this operation. And things are, in general, shrunk toward the zero state. So you could think about this as describing some kind of a cooling process where, you know, where the qubit is cooled towards its ground state if its ground state is the zero state. OK. So these are all examples of, you know, the kinds of noise that might occur to our qubits when we try to build a quantum computer. And they're the kinds of things we might have to try to correct against if we think about quantum error correcting codes. Yes?
Again, about the name amplitude damping, is it going to be the amplitude or modulus of all over the decreasing because this is a sequence map, so the amplitude that's decreasing is...
Well, the amplitude of the one state is decreasing, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's where the name comes. So here, yeah, the amplitudes of the 0 and 1 states are not changing, although, of course, you know, the amplitude of the plus and minus states is changing, so... I don't know, it's just a name. Okay, so there's a nice characterization of quantum operations. Well, there are several nice characterizations of quantum operations that all give us different ways of understanding how these conditions arise. And I don't know, maybe you've seen some of these before, but I'm guessing probably not all of them. So I want to just mention some of the different ways of representing quantum operations. So, following our equivalent, so first of all, E is a quantum operation, so it's a completely positive trace-preserving linear map. So the second is that the map has something that looks, like some generalization of this form. So E of rho is the sum over I AI rho AI dagger for some operators A sub I that are not necessarily unitary or anything like that. They have to satisfy the following condition, though. The sum over I of AI dagger AI should be the identity matrix. So you can check that this condition is actually satisfied for these matrices A0 and A1. Have you seen this before? Probably. Yeah, okay. So this is what's called the Krauss representation. And these AIs are called Krauss operators. So another representation is the following. So I'm going to define some matrix, which is called J of E. And it's the following. So I'm going to, I can think about this J as sort of acting with E on half of a maximally entangled state. So E tensor the identity operation on the state, which is, well, let me just write it as psi. And actually, for convenience, I'm going to define this thing to be an unnormalized maximally entangled state. So this thing is just the sum over I. Okay, so if I were to divide by 1 over the square root of the dimension, this would be a maximally entangled state between two systems of the same dimension. So here the dimension of the space that I acts on is the same as the dimension of the space that E acts on. Okay, so this thing is called the Choi-Jamiokowski representation. Have you seen this before? Do you know what the conditions are for the thing to be? So there's some additional conditions. You know, there's some conditions on this J of E in order for the thing to be a completely positive trace-preserving map. Have you seen them before? Did you see them in the quantum information course? Or? Okay. So the two conditions are the following. So J of E should be a positive semi-definite matrix. So that's a pretty easy thing to check because you just compute what this matrix is. I mean, you know, this one seems like maybe it would be hard to check, right? Because it just says if you want to check that it's a completely positive map, you should find that there exists some A sub I's for which this is satisfied. Well, how do you actually look for them? Okay, but here, if you know what the action of E is, it's pretty straightforward. First of all, it has to be that the Choi-Jamiokowski state is positive semi-definite. So this thing you can think of as, well, up to normalization, you could think of it as a density matrix because it's just like what you get if you apply some quantum operation on some quantum state. And then the other thing is that if you trace out the reference system, you trace out the B part of this system, thinking of this as the A part and this is the B part, so the trace over B of the Choi-Jamiokowski state, you should get just the identity. Or if you were to normalize things so that this was a normalized quantum state, you would get the maximally mixed state. Okay, so, yes?
When is it advantageous to use representation 3? Why are we concerned with it?
Well, so one reason you might want to use it is if you know what the action of some map is and you want to really check that it's a completely positive trace-preserving map, these are some conditions which are easy to check, right? But if I just tell you what the action of, you know how to compute what E does on an arbitrary, input state row, how would you come up with these A sub I's, in order to see that you actually have this representation? Now, it turns out that there's some nice connection between any of these different representations that I'm mentioning, and from this way of thinking about things, you could come up with the A sub I's. But, if you want to just directly check whether the thing is a CPTP map, maybe it's easier to do it in this representation.
So it's easier to check the conditions in 3 than checking whether it's CPTP linear?
Well, okay, so how would you check that it's a CPTP linear map? You have to check that it's linear, trace preserving, and completely positive. I guess maybe, linear is clear. Maybe trace preserving is not so bad either because you can think about applying it to a basis of states. But how do you check that it's completely positive? Right? This has to be true for all positive semi-definite row. So how are you going to check it on all positive semi-definite matrices row? It's like infinitely many things you have to check. So that sounds kind of hard. But this says you can just check it, you can like just compute what are the eigenstates of this thing and show that they all have non-negative eigenvalues. Okay. Then there's one last representation, which is called the sign spring representation, which is the thing that relates this all to this Church of the Larger Hilbert space picture, which is that we can think about applying some unitary operation to our input state together with some reference system. So this says that E of rho can be thought of as the trace over some reference system of U acting on rho, tensor, some ancilla in the zero state, U dagger. Or in other words, in a more quantum circuit kind of picture, we can think about sending in here rho, and here's some reference system in the pure state zero. Then we do some unitary, and then we throw this system in the garbage. We just discard it, and then what comes out here is E of rho. So this is called the sign spring representation. And it's part of this theorem that a map is a quantum operation if and only if it has a sign spring representation. So you can always think about realizing any quantum operation as performing some unitary interaction with some ancilla system that you could think of as the environment, and then forgetting about the fact that you have the environment, maybe because you don't have access to it. Okay, so that's always a way that you can realize a quantum operation. And so, if you want to think about what all these representations mean, something you could do would be to, for all of these maps, try to think about what is their representation. So for example, how would you realize amplitude damping as some kind of a unitary interaction with an environment? So I'm definitely not going to prove this theorem now. Maybe you've seen some of the parts of the proof before. But if you want to see how all of these representations relate to one another, there's some pretty good discussion in the Nielsen and Chuang textbook. But what actually I would really recommend is there's some lecture notes by John Watrous so he has this course on the theory of quantum information, which is sort of like mathematical foundations of quantum information. And he has some really nice lecture notes where he talks about many things, but one of the things he talks about is the relationship between all of these maps. So you can go to his webpage and find those notes if you're interested. Yes?
Can you say his name again?
Yeah, I can write it. So it's John Watchers. He's in the computer science department at Waterloo. Yes?
For some reason, I'm having a little trouble combining this with something that we said earlier.
Okay.
When constructing the Stein spring representation, we tensor row with just a pure zero state.
Yes.
And then perform a unitary on a pole. Performing a unitary on a pole suggests to me that the pole is a pure state.
It doesn't have to be. I mean, you can think about applying a unitary operation to a mixed quantum state, just like we did over here. So, yeah. Okay. Oh, yes.
What is the T? What kind of requirement do you need? unique, or if you introduce another reference, the reference system.
Yes.
So what kind of operation is that?
I guess I'm just not sure which operation you're talking about.
The third one.
So in the third line, so you want to know what this state is, like e tensor I of.
I just want to know what that operation is.
Oh, that's an I. That's me trying to write a cursive I.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. My handwriting is terrible. So, so it's the same I that I used over here.
So, what kind of requirement do we need?
So this is just the identity. This is just the quantum operation that does not.
This is
so
identity.
I of row equals row.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. It's just just my lousy handwriting. Yes.
In question four, when you say that we throw something out.
Yes.
So when we throw it out, are we careful like not to measure anything about it when we throw it out?
You can measure it and then you can throw it out, or you can just throw it out. You can do a unitary on it and then throw it out. You can do a quantum operation on it of any kind and then throw it out. And all those things are the same, because if you're going to throw it out, it doesn't matter what you did to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess what I'm thinking is, so let's say U is some sort of entangling gate.
Okay.
Such that
it has to be a general fruit for you to get.
So what you put in ends up being entangled with that. So let's say that you get 0, 0 plus 1, 1.
Right.
Then when you throw out the second system, does that put the first one back into a superposition?
No.
No.
It becomes a mixed state. I mean, that's sort of exactly why you do this,
right?
So, for example, if you, this is a good example. So, suppose U is a CNOT gate, right? So, so suppose we have this. We're going to put this in the zero state, and then there are two possibilities. We could put this in the zero state or the one state, and then the output will be either the 0, 0 state or the 1, 1 state. So we just entangled the two registers if we put this thing in superposition, right? So then if we put in the state 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1, then you know the output of this channel would be, the output of this circuit would be 1 over root 2, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, i.e. an entangled state. Okay, but then if we trace out this qubit, now what we have is a maximally mixed state, right? So then if we trace this thing out and we just want to talk about what the density matrix is over here, then actually rho is the identity divided by 2. That's kind of exactly what's happening, is the environment is getting information about which basis state we have, and if you don't have access to that information, the best description you can give is one in which you're actually going to make quantum.
Why single up the zero state in the Steinstein representation? Why not just put an arbitrary pure state?
You could put an arbitrary pure state because you could send 0 to an arbitrary pure state by some action of this unitary. It's just some standard choice. You can put in anything you want. Good, other questions? Okay, so then the last thing that I wanted to do was talk about generalized measurement, and this is something which maybe will be new to more of you. And this will be an important notion because we want to talk about things like, how distinguishable are quantum states, right? So if we have two quantum states, what's the best thing that we can do to tell them apart? And in order to do that, we have to think about the most general measurements we might be able to do, right? So we have this notion of measuring in the computational basis, or slightly more generally, we could think about projective measurements, where we, project onto, we sort of partition up our space into a bunch of orthogonal subspaces, and then we project onto one of them. But that's not the most general kind of measurement, which is allowed by quantum mechanics. And so we should think about what's the most general kind of measurement that we can actually do. So here's the most general kind of measurement we can actually do. If we look back at the Krauss representation, it basically corresponds to doing this kind of quantum operation described by a Krauss representation, but getting to know which Krauss operator actually was performed. Okay, so. So the most general kind of measurement in quantum mechanics is described by a set of measurement operators, which you can really think of as the Krauss operators of the measurement, these operators will be written M sub I, and they have to satisfy the same normalization condition that was satisfied in the Krauss representation. So they should satisfy that the sum over I of MI dagger MI is equal to the identity. Okay, but now this is a measurement, so it's not just the same as performing a quantum operation. Now we have to talk about the probabilities of different measurement outcomes and the post-measurement state after we get some particular measurement outcome. So if we perform the measurement, which is described by these measurement operators M sub I, the probability that we get outcome I will be given by the trace of operator mi dagger mi times rho, where rho is the density matrix of the quantum state. And so if we have a system that has the density matrix rho, and we perform a measurement that, that's described by these measurement operators, these are the measurement statistics. And now you can see why we wanted it to be the case that the sum over I of mi dagger mi is the identity. If that's the case, then if we were to sum up all of the probabilities, we would get 1, right? Because we could push the sum inside the trace, because the trace is linear. This sum would give us the identity, and we also know that the trace of rho is 2. Right? So then this would be our normalization condition, that we always get some outcome when we perform a measurement. OK, but we can also talk about what is the post-measurement state. So if we perform a measurement, which is described by these measurement operators M sub I, the post-measurement state, when we get the outcome I, will be mi rho mi dagger, except that we may have to renormalize it, because just like when we take a pure quantum state and we project it onto a particular basis vector that we might be if we measure in some particular basis, we have to normalize the state again to get something which is trace 1. And the thing we have to normalize by is exactly the probability, right? So we should divide by the trace of mi dagger mi rho. And you can easily verify that this thing is a trace 1 matrix just by taking the trace and using the cyclic property of the trace to see that then the numerator becomes the same thing as the denominator. Okay, so now, if we consider the special case where the mi's are a bunch of orthogonal projections, then this gives us exactly a projective measurement. So a projective measurement is the special case, or von Neumann measurement, is the special case where the MIs are orthogonal projectors. And this is the case we're familiar with. So for example, if we wanted to talk about computational basis measurement, the MIs would just be the projectors onto the computational basis. But we don't have to consider that. We could consider more generally any set of measurement operators satisfying this normalization. Okay, now if we don't actually care about the post-measurement state, but we only care about the probabilities that we get the different measurement outcomes, notice that we don't actually need all of the information that's in these measurement operators M sub I, because the only combination that appears in the in the description of the this thing is sometimes called the Born rule, so the thing that tells us how to compute the probabilities of the different measurement outcomes, the only thing that matters is mi dagger times mi. So if we just think about the set of the operators of the form mi dagger times mi that specify the measurement, this is all we need to talk about the measurement outcomes, we get what's called a POVM. So if we don't care about the post-measurement states, then it suffices to consider a POVM, so this stands for positive operator valued measure, but I think nobody ever says that, they just say POVM. And this is something that has what are called elements, so the POVM elements are the operators E sub I, which are simply mi dagger mi. So the condition for something to be a POVM is that, well, first of all, these E sub I operators clearly have to be positive semi-definite. Because anytime you have a matrix that you can factorize as, you know, the adjoint of some matrix times that matrix, this gives you a positive semi-definite matrix. So these EIs have to be positive semi-definite matrices. That's the P part of P of M. And they also have to satisfy this normalization condition. So they have to be a resolution of the identity that the sum over IEI is the identity. And then if we have a P of M, then we know that the probability that we get some particular measurement outcome I is just the trace of EI times rho. And now we can't say exactly what the you know, post-measurement state is, because there might be different ways of realizing some given P of M in terms of different measurement operators. But you know, that's fine if all we care about is the statistics of the different measurements. So I guess for measurement, you know, we should again talk about purification, right? So like here, we talked about some kind of general operation, and you know, at this point, you might be thinking like, why should I believe you? Why is this? Why do you just say that this is what a measurement is? I mean, what's the justification for that? So it turns out that there's again a way of thinking about these operations in terms of purification, and the picture is, you know, I mean, since this looks a lot like the Krauss representation, I guess it's no surprise that you can do something like this. So again, you can think about realizing any generalized measurement unitarily through some interaction with an ancilla system. So any generalized measurement can be realized unitarily. Can be realized through some unitary interaction with an ancilla followed by a computational basis measurement, followed by a projective measurement, by unitary interaction with an ancilla, the reference system, and a projective measurement. So maybe I'll just draw the picture for that. So, you know, we have our density matrix rho that we might want to perform some generalized measurement on, and then we'll have some ancilla which, without loss of generality, we can say we prepare in the zero state. And then we can consider some unitary operation where now we're going to have three outputs. I'm not going to specify exactly what the dimensions of the outputs are, but they'll be, you know, since this thing will be something unitary, they'll be something so that the total dimension of the output is the same as the total dimension of the input. And we'll get out here, so first of all, a state which is, you know, which is going to be this post-measurement state. So it's going to be, you know, mi rho mi dagger divided by the trace of mi dagger mi rho. And then we'll have some other register that if we just measure it using some projective measurement will give us the outcome I. So this is the state, you know, the output state of the first register when we get the measurement outcome I. And then, in general, we may have some other piece of the system that we throw in the trash. Yes?
You said unitary interaction with an ancilla. Does the ancilla need to be in the first state?
Well, so let me put it this way. The ancilla doesn't have to be in a mixed state. So, of course, if you thought about what you could do with ancillas prepared in mixed states, that would give you some... you know, you might think that maybe you could do more, but actually that's not the case, right? Because if you ever put in here a mixed state, you could always purify that, possibly making the system even bigger. But I didn't say anything here about how big the system was. So you could purify this into a potentially bigger system and extend the unitary to act on everything. So it wouldn't actually give you any more power.
So ultimately, the rho that we want to measure needs to be tensored with a pure state at some point in the beginning.
You can always think of it that way. You can always purify everything. You can even purify rho, because rho has some purification. You purify it with a reference system if, you know, you came up with some realization of this where instead of feeding in zero, you had some mixed state. You could purify that with some reference system, and now everything is pure. I mean, you're always free to do this. It may cost you a bit more dimension, but you can always do it in principle. And that's often a useful thing to do in calculations when you want to work things out. Yes?
And why is generalized measurement of this form?
Why is a generalized measurement of this form? So, you know, certainly this is something that you can imagine doing within the framework of quantum.
Sorry, I mean, that why, is it a, am I, like, am I, why those rules? Like, why is that the most general
So, I mean, there's something here that I'm not proving, but the claim is that if you consider anything of this form, where you consider some unitary interaction with an environment, and then you measure part of the system, you throw part of the system away, and you keep part of the system, it will always be described by some measurement.
That's how we define generalized measurement, and then that...
Yeah, maybe that's how you should think about it, is this is how the thing is defined. I mean, really, you know, we sort of believe that fundamentally quantum mechanics is unitary. We have these postulates that say, you know, there's Schrodinger dynamics. So that's kind of what's underlying everything. The reason there's a notion of generalized measurement is just that we could think about interacting our system with some larger system, and that might actually give us some more power. And so actually the last thing that I wanted to mention was just an example where you see that this actually does give you more power. But we're not going to do the example, but I'll leave it for you as an exercise you could do. It's not one of the tutorial or assignment exercises, but just something you could think about if you're curious. So sometimes POVMs are better than projective measurements. And here's an example. I think this is probably, you know, kind of the simplest example where that's the case. So suppose we have a qubit, which is prepared in a pure state. And it's prepared in one of three possible pure states. So let me draw, like, maybe this is like the XZ plane of the block sphere. Here I have the zero state, say. And it doesn't really matter so much what state that is. But what matters is the relationship between the states. So suppose I take these three states, which are what are called sometimes the trine states, right? So this angle is 2 pi over 3, and this angle is also 2 pi over 3, and this one's also 2 pi. Okay, so this is a picture of, you know, some slice through the block sphere. I have the zero state, and then I have the other two states, which are, you know, an angle, which are kind of equidistant from each other in this slice through the block sphere. Okay, so this defines three states, and suppose what I do is I prepare one of these three possible states, each with probability a third. So I flip a three-sided coin, and if I get, you know, zero, I get this. If I get one, I prepare this. If I get two, I prepare this. And then I hand you the state, and I don't tell you which state I gave you. And I ask you to guess which state it is. And you want to figure out, you know, what's the highest probability, with the highest possible probability, you want to figure out which state you were given. So certainly something that you could do would be to perform a projective measurement in some basis. You think about, you know, orienting your measurement apparatus in some way, and then try to guess which state you were given, and try to figure out what's the best possible way to do that. It kind of seems like there's a problem, though, because, of course, since this is a state of a qubit, you're only going to be able to guess two possible things. You'll never be able to guess, you know, the third outcome. Now, of course, it's clear that you can't, you know, it's clear that you can't possibly distinguish these states perfectly, so maybe that's not surprising that you have some limitations to what you can do with a projective measurement, because it's just not possible to distinguish the states perfectly. But nevertheless, you might, you know, try to see if you could do better using POVMs, and it turns out that you can. So what you could think about is, you know, what's the possible projective measurement you could do to distinguish these states, and then you would have to have a strategy for which, you know, which measurement outcome corresponds to what guess you should make. And then you could think about, well, what's the best POVM you could do, which you could think about as, you know, interacting this system with some reference system and then jointly measuring the whole thing according to some projective measurement. Or you could just directly try to construct a POVM and try to see, you know, what's the best success probability in each of those cases. And in this case, it turns out that you actually will do better with the POVM. So when we talk about the distinguishability of quantum states, so next time we're going to talk about distance measures between quantum states, what we can say about distinguishability of quantum states, and maybe if we have time, we'll start talking about entropy. And so in order to make sense, you know, make some kind of operational sense of what it means to say how distinguishable two states are, we'll have to think about the best possible measurement that we could do, and so we'll be thinking about, in general, performing POVMs. Okay. Any other questions?